Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers, sitting in temporarily for Celeste Quinn in this hour. So I can do this interview with Alan Weisman. What would our planet look like if, for some reason, humans suddenly disappeared? We've done a lot on and to our planet, so what would remain of our civilization, and in what ways would the Earth and its inhabitants change without our presence? What would be left where any other intelligent life would know that we were here? Well, there is a book called The World Without Us, and Alan Weisman traveled all over the world in search for a thorough answer to that question. What would happen if we were to suddenly go away? Alan Weisman is a journalist and international journalism professor at the University of Arizona, and he joins us today from Minneapolis. He'll be in the Chicago area at the end of this week. You can join in the conversation now during our 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Give us a call with your questions for Alan Weisman and the book. The number is 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana in the local calling area. Outside the area, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Alan Weisman, good afternoon.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So, hey,
before we begin, correction.
Okay.
I will not be in Chicago until November.
You're right.
Yeah, November 8th. I will be at a program sponsored by the Chicago Peace Museum, and I'm not sure where they're holding that.
It's at the Chicago Public Library downtown.
Ah, great. And then the following night, I will be giving a talk in Evanston, which is sort of a homecoming for me because I'm a Northwestern graduate.
All right. And that's at the Barnes & Noble on Sherman Avenue, and that's a month from now, so you've got a while. How did you come up with this question? It's hypothetical. It seems simple enough, and as you prove in the book, it's a very complex answer.
Yeah, I have been a journalist my whole career, and for about 20, 25 years, more and more, stories are all environmental stories. The environment, of course, impacts everything by definition. And I've traveled all over the globe. I've been to many of the really hot spots, literally, like burning rainforests, Chernobyl. I've been to thawing permafrost in the North Pole and an ozone hole hovering over the South Pole. And I've been looking for a way to bring all of this global understanding together, to get people to realize that all these events are connected and the connection comes through us, and yet to do it in such a way that everybody's not so overwhelmed or fearful or guilt-ridden that they say, you know, who wants to read this stuff? And finally, it occurred to me through a suggestion of an editor, and we talked it out, that if I just supposed a world in which instead of us sitting around worrying about, oh, are we all going to die from this, that suppose we were already dead. I mean, it's a remote possibility, but just enough to make it not science fiction. I mean, suppose a Homo sapiens-specific virus kicks us off, say AIDS were airborne, or bird flu suddenly exploded, or some evil genius figured out a way to sterilize our sperm, or since a lot of people believe in raptures, you know, maybe some religious figure or space aliens rapture us away from the Earth. Just something to clear the decks of us, so we could see, without all of our distractions, a little more clearly what is here besides us, and how would it get along without our constant daily pressures that we heap on it, and also, how would it deal with the stuff that we would leave behind? Like all the carbon we've pumped up into the atmosphere, how long would it take for that to die down, and what about all the stuff, you know, ranging from a big city like Chicago with its Sears Towers, etc., or, you know, all of our artwork, everything that we have done, all the materials we've created. In other words, what would happen? And this seems to be a mechanism that does disarm that fear factor and yet gives people this seductively irresistible glimpse of the future which as a reporter I put together by talking to all these incredible people all over the world, informed scientists, eyewitnesses, just a whole variety of people that give us a good educated guess of what might happen. And that's pretty much the genesis of it.
Interesting you talk about, you know, some of the doom and gloom environmental stories that we hear, and it does start to weigh on people. And one book reviewer, when I'm talking about your book, says that, you know, a lot of these environmental books are tend to be Jeremiads. They're scary prophecies, and then they follow it up with the moral, don't do this, or you know, save our planet in some way. Did you intend not to get into that with this book?
Well, I am a journalist. I was trained to be one. I started at the Medill School of Journalism up there in Northwestern.
Right.
And we are, you know, we are bound by our professional ethics as much as possible to let the facts speak for themselves. Now, activists oftentimes will, you know, lead with their passions, and we owe them a great deal, because that's very important to, you know, have people go out there and, you know, and stand out and take a position. But journalists try to, you know, use the tools of journalism, which is simple reporting, to present things to readers and, to the greatest possible extent, let the readers decide for themselves. And in this case, you know, the facts are cumulative, because I go all over the world and talk to so many people, and they become very persuasive. It sort of becomes obvious both that we are having a tremendous impact on the Earth right now, because of stuff that we are doing, which I show in the form of stuff that we will leave behind, but also, and you know, this is really one of the most important things that comes out of my research, is it's incredible how resilient life is. I go to some amazing places where human beings have abandoned for one reason or another. Some of them, they've just sort of left behind, and they have reverted to their natural state. I mean, the Korean Demilitarized Zone.
Right.
It's become this incredibly important nature preserve accidentally in Asia. And some of them we've left because we've contaminated them horribly, like sites where we've made nerve gas or Chernobyl itself. Mm-hmm. And yet nature is constantly finding a way to experiment to find what will grow in there when we are not taking up all that space. And life just keeps going on and on and on. This in some altered form, but it does go on, and that is a really comforting fact to understand.
You take us to those places, yet for simplicity's sake, I guess you start off the book just by going to a regular suburb, something we're all familiar with, as to what would happen as far as the decay, I suppose, after a day or a week or a year and many years. Of an area we all know about.
Right. Well, actually, just before that, there's a chapter in which I take people, I mean, very much as those astute authors of Genesis did, and I take everybody back to paradise. I start in the last fragment of old-growth forest in Europe, which is kind of the one that we see in our mind's eye when we read Grimm's fairy tales when we're kids. And there's this place that has been preserved as a royal game preserve since the 14th century by Polish kings and then Russian czars and then even the Nazis, because Hermann Göring was sort of this nature fanatic. And now it's a Polish and Belarusian national park. And I take us back there because you go into this thing and you see all the kinds of, you know, trees, hardwoods, temperate forests like we have, you know, here in the Northern Hemisphere. And yet it's amazing how much it seems sort of familiar, even more right than the kind of forest that, you know, these sort of puny second growth forests that we have here now. And once I've established this sort of reconnection with nature, then I go to look at the walls that we have built to separate us from nature, and I show, you know, as you point out, how quickly they will come down if we're not maintaining them. So I have a chapter about how your house would go about falling apart if you weren't there constantly trying to keep nature from invading it. Nature in the form of mold, of insects, of small mammals, and mostly water, because water will relentlessly find its way in. And once it gets in, if nobody is taking care of the damage, it's going to start allowing all sorts of things to start decaying, loosening up nails, rusting them out, and letting more water come in through those nail holes and eventually destabilizing. I mean, a roof leak, if left untended, is just going to bring down a house, certainly a wooden house, within a century. Maybe the chimney will still be there. The bathroom tile will last an awful long time because it's ceramics are pretty much like fossils. They're down at a very low energy state. There's not much further. You'll have to break them down. But even some of our most resilient materials are the ones that we think of are just going to really either deteriorate or they're going to disconnect from one another.
Funny to think that the last remaining evidence of our existence in a suburb would be bathroom tiles.
Well, that's pretty much it. I mean, one of the questions that's sort of left hanging in that chapter is aluminum. We don't know very much about refined aluminum because it's so new. We didn't know how to refine it until we had electricity, because it takes electricity. You can't just smelt it like you can iron ore or copper ore. Mm-hmm. But anybody who's got, like, you know, one of those aluminum runners on your shower door, you'll see like little white pits in it. So obviously there are chemical reactions that are going to bring aluminum back. One of the experts that I talked to is a metallurgist. He's head of the Department of Colorado School of Mines. And he explained that all of our refined metals are in what we call a higher energy state because we sort of kicked them up from the way they're found in nature into something that is more malleable and useful to our purposes. But nature, when allowed to, will bring it back to, you know, it's like water seeking its own level. It'll bring it back down to some kind of, you know, oxide,
right.
Just like iron rusts. And everything pretty much will go. He did tell me that of all the human-created alloys, bronze is one of the most durable of all, which is why we know about the Bronze Age. We get sculptures, and it's kind of nice to think that Rodin, you know, will be left long after we're gone for someone to find.
Mm-hmm. From there, you take it to sort of a more macro scale, I guess. We go to Manhattan, and you explain bit by bit how that same kind of decay to modern structures that happen in a large city. And then from there into, you know, some more, actually one pretty jarring example would be the oil and gas and chemical complexes around Houston, which shocked me as far as exactly what is stored and what happens and what kind of balance there is just to keep chemical plants and oil plants going without catastrophe.
Yeah, I mean, one comment I can make about both of those chapters you just cited is that, you know, it's one thing to think of a house coming down, but to think of a whole city, and yet it turns out Manhattan will revert to a forest like it was before Henry Hudson first saw it. The forest will be slightly changed because we've introduced a lot of plants. But subway engineers, maintenance personnel, took me underneath the city to show me how it would happen. Again, water. The subways are below the water table. And there used to be all these surface waters in New York. There were rivers that drained all the hills, but those hills got smashed down to put a street grid on top of them, and so even the groundwater of Manhattan is now mostly subsurface water, and they have to keep nearly 800 pumps going all the time to keep the subways drained. And if they weren't there, or if maintenance personnel were not showing up at the power plants, the subways would fill up with water within just a few days, and then the columns holding up the street would begin to rust, and then they would corrode, and then finally the streets would collapse and start having surface water there. And, Chicago's L system, you know, you're close enough to Lake Michigan that I'm sure that there are, I didn't study it for this book, but I'm sure that there are similar situations where the L goes underground.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, that's something that you really have to think about because, we all have seen sometimes when old infrastructure gets old enough to start to fail, or when new infrastructure is built not to the standards, you know, of the times when they used to just heap on so much mass because nobody knew, you know, what the tolerances were. So like Boston's Big Dig, the concrete roof starts falling down because they use the wrong epoxy or too cheap an epoxy.
Right.
So, you know, these are big concerns. Once there are no human maintenance personnel, plants will be growing up indiscriminately through sidewalks, and it's amazing how fast it'll happen. I go to a village, it's a seaside resort in Cyprus that got orphaned during the Cyprus Civil War in the 70s. It was brand new then, and now plants have so overtaken it that none of the buildings is salvageable, even though they were new concrete steel buildings 30 years ago. Plants are just growing right through the rooftops. In the petrochemical chapter...
I tell you what, before we go to the chapter about Houston, let's take a couple of calls since they've been hanging on for a little bit. The number is again 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana and 1-800-222-9455. Got a call in Sugar Grove, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Good subs, actually. I was wondering, did you do any studies on plastic, the new plastics, the composite type stuff, that they use for decking and other such things? What's the life cycle of that as far as decay? And I got a point to add. I used to work for the Forest Service years ago, and I used to study what Mother Nature used to do hundreds of years ago before even mankind came through. And, there used to be, quite frequent lightning strikes around, and a lot of fires would through and burn off everything. Kind of on the contrary of what we do now is we put them out, which is not good. And how does Mother Nature affect that as far as natural disasters and whatnot? I'll get off and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Funny you mentioned plastics. There's a whole chapter on that, too.
Yeah. Just in reverse order, I do mention the fact that without human beings, there would be no firemen on Earth.
Right.
And, of course, there are two ways of looking at it. Forests used to manage themselves, and fire was one of the elements. Lightning would periodically burn forests, and that means that, some of the biggest, tallest trees would survive, and the smaller ones would get thinned out. Then later on, as human beings showed up, including on our continent, indigenous Americans, the very earliest ones, knew how to sometimes, create pastures so it would be easier to hunt or, create areas where they could corner deer for, there were all kinds of techniques that used fire to shape forests. In New York City or any city, if no one's raking up all the leaves that would gather in the gutters, or the branches falling in the parks, a lightning strike would eventually ignite those things probably within about the first 5 years, and then we would have a fire in the cities that would add, from insulation on the sides of buildings to paper inside the offices, et cetera. That would add a lot of carbon to the new soil cap forming on the city. Plastics, which grow out of my chapter on the petrochemical industry, because plastics, one of the newest hydrocarbon-based substances in the world, invented in the 20th century, entered the mainstream after World War II, and microbes don't know how to eat it yet. They have not been around here long enough for them to develop the enzymes that will digest it. So plastic experts explained to me that was kind of the same thing that happened when trees first appeared on Earth, and they didn't know how to deal with lignin, so a lot of those original tree trunks just of decay, and they just got buried eventually, and that's why we have so much coal and carbon, because that stuff just got compressed, our coal-bearing layers. So plastic, eventually they say microbes will learn how to eat it. There's lots of different kinds of plastics, so it's going to take a lot of adaptation, but not before a lot of it gets buried and enters the fossil record. And in the meantime, because it's such light stuff, it's blowing... like everything eventually rose to the sea, a lot of it's blowing on the wind or being carried on streams, and it's going out to the oceans, and there are some literally continent-sized rafts of floating plastic out there now, and wave action is breaking it up into smaller and smaller particles. The listener asked about, what about decking and things like that?
Right.
Well, it'll fall apart in terms of its connection to, through nails, et cetera, but it'll be lying down there on the ground, and it'll lie there for a long time. Ultraviolet can break up some polymer chains, but all it is doing is creating smaller pieces of plastic, and it's going to be in our ecosystem for hundreds of thousands of years, perhaps at least thousands of years, until microbes learn how to eat the stuff.
That was one of the more jarring chapters, again, when you talk about plastics, was I'm not sure whether you went there or you're talking about the middle of the Pacific Ocean in the North Pacific, because of ocean currents, there's this area that you mentioned is pretty much a floating pile of old plastic and plastic that doesn't decompose.
Yeah, I travel to virtually every place in this book that I talk about, and I flew over that area. I was with the marine biologists in England who have been studying how wave action is turning plastic into smaller and smaller pieces that smaller and smaller organisms are now mistaken for something organic and eating. And then the last chapter of my book, I went to the middle of the Pacific with oceanographers marine biologists, I mean, a whole raft of scientists, to look at how would the seas come back if we weren't around.
Right. But one thing that you mentioned that I'm not sure if anybody would give it any thought, even the tiniest things that we make out of plastics are something that have some sort of impact.
Well,
you mentioned just the scrubbing things that come in exfoliants, you know, those creams that contain tiny little pebbles that I guess at one point were natural substances but now are just little pebbles of plastic.
You know, this was a real shock to me. It was bad enough to know that our, you know, unintended consequences of what we do, that our plastics are finding their way into the ecosystem and breaking up into smaller pieces that creatures eat. That's kind of an accident. But it turns out that very intentionally, cosmetic companies and most of them, you know, people who use these facial exfoliants, you know, to scrub the dead skin cells away, you have to read the labels, because there are some good ones out there that use things like crushed jojoba seeds or crushed apricot kernels as that sort of nice little comforting abrasive. But most of them are using, the trade word is microbeads, and there's various different euphemisms there, but it all comes down to little pieces of polyethylene, and you're flushing it right down your drain, and eventually it's finding the ocean, and it's eventually finding its way into the mouth of some unsuspecting creature, or some filter feeder is sucking it in, and it's down to the level that zooplankton are ingesting this stuff, and our food chain is based on plankton. This is a serious issue.
And it will take a while, as you mentioned, for microbes to learn in time to get rid of it. And even if we're not there and making more of it,
it
will stick around. Let's take another call in Eureka. Let's go to line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. A very interesting conversation. You sort of asked my question. I was going to ask how long does it take for plastics to break down, but it sort of brought up another that I've heard. I don't know if it was on WILL or PBS, but someone who had been to Midway Island, then someone who, I believe, had commented on Antarctica. And I guess the conclusion I would draw that virtually over all the Earth, plastics are there, and as you cited the problem of them breaking down into smaller and smaller parts, I guess from what I have heard, plastics will be in the landfills for hundreds of years. I'm wondering, is this true for papers? And something like is... Well, dreadful that you think about disposable diapers too. I guess they would probably be in the landfill stream for hundreds and hundreds of years. Is that true?
Yeah, it's probably thousands. You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because we constantly have this question. It's just like a Zen koan that is put to us in a grocery store: paper or plastic. And I asked Bill Rathke, who's an archaeologist at Stanford, who's one of the world's experts on garbage. He and his students have been excavating landfills for decades now. And it turns out that, you know, paper is biodegradable, much more so than plastic. But if you bury it and the oxygen isn't getting to it, nothing's going to biodegrade it. So they go down into landfills and they find newspapers nearly a century old that they can still read.
Oh, my goodness.
So... I was given a talk in Colorado about a month or so ago, and someone asked, you know, well, what can we do about this? And it happened to be a political, it was like a Young Democrats club that invited me to speak, and there were lots of candidates show up at these things. So it occurred to me to say, you know, here's something you can do. And I pointed to all the candidates that were standing in the room to meet these people, and I said, ask which of them are willing to pledge, if elected, to the Colorado legislature, that they will introduce a bill making it a crime to give away a free bag in a grocery store. And, you know, of course, some of them, they weren't expecting this, and they were a little uncomfortable. But, you know, if you think about it, before World War II, she did not go and put the tomatoes in one plastic bag and the cucumbers in another and the onions in another, bananas in another. You know, what, the flavors are going to mix? You know, there's no reason for us to do this other than that they give us these bags, so we just sort of think, oh, we're supposed to do this. She bought one bag from home, filled it up with everything, took it home, dumped it out. She probably used that same bag for decades. And if we went into supermarkets and no one gave us bags, we would learn to bring them from home and to recycle them, and we would save an enormous amount of plastic. Just ask those maintenance people up there who keep our sewers clear of plastic bags, because that's where they're all headed. And they'll clog them up without those people helping us out.
Thank you.
And thanks. Thanks for your call. Our numbers again are 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. If you have a question for Alan Wiseman, journalist and the author of the book, The World Without Us. We wanted to go back to one of the places you visit as far as posing that, again, question, what would happen if humans went away? A place, again, where human activity sort of keeps it all going, kind of like the subways, where you have to have somebody to pump the water out in order to keep it going. The Houston Petrochemical Complex as well is one of those places that catastrophe can happen, and you say probably would happen if we were all to go away.
Well, there's two scenarios. I mean, you know, you look at these places. I went to this stretch between Houston and Galveston. It's the longest continuous stretch in the world of this petroscape of, you know, tanks, layers and cracking towers and pipelines, and it was kind of fun talking to Texas ecologists about, okay, so what was here before this, you know, barely a century ago, and would it all come back? And in one scenario, if human beings, when they depart, you know, at least take enough time to bank the fires and turn off all the machinery, probably most of that stuff would just sort of gunk up inside all that steel. And the stuff corrodes. I mean, tanks have to be replaced about every 20 years or so. And there are microbes now that have learned how to eat petroleum and a lot of our petroleum products. Now, granted, there are a lot of petrochemical industries in those in that area that also make plastics, so we know that some of that stuff will take longer. But a lot of this gunk will get eaten by microbes. Now, granted, it would be very slow by our reckoning, our time scale, but nature's got all the time in the world, literally. And it'll eventually get eaten, and that still will rust away, and yes, the ecosystem will come back. I mean, some of those byproducts of what the microbes eat will actually nourish plants to come back. If everybody left all at once, though, I mean, there might be some rather dramatic, explosive departures. People from the petroleum industry explained to me that there are good fail-safe mechanisms, that even when a disaster happens, which unfortunately does, and a plant has an explosion, it generally does, it really almost never spreads to a neighboring plant because they cut it off. But some of the inspectors told me privately that, you know, there are human beings that are monitoring this stuff all the time. And if they weren't there, there is definitely a very good chance that we would get a chain reaction, that fire would just spread to the next plant. And there could be an awful lot of ugly, oily smoke coming out of that chemical alley that stretches from Houston all the way to the Gulf Coast of Louisiana.
Then again, that would have that own, you know, an impact there, but as you say, perhaps nature would learn to adapt to that eventually.
Oh, sure. But again, you know, nature has a different time scale than we do. And ultimately, you know, I didn't write The World Without Us because I think that the world would be better off if we were just cleared off the planet. I think that we're a species as well. We're a mammalian species. We deserve to be here. It took a long time to figure, you know, to evolve to the point where we're at. And I would like to think of a world in which there was a place for us, but obviously we have become so powerful, we can go so far and dig so deep and harvest so much, and, you know, we're pushing other stuff off the planet. So ultimately I wrote this book so people could think of, well, how can we remain here but be much in better balance with nature, so nature could heal and refresh itself. That didn't ultimately depend on our untimely extinction.
We have another call for Alan Wiseman. This one's from Bourbonnais. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. While I was on hold, the volume in my earpiece just dropped way down, so I can't hear you real clearly.
Well, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay, great. Well, I could listen on the radio then.
Okay, great.
I have a couple of comments and a couple of questions. The Wild Oats chain of grocery stores, are you familiar with them?
Yeah.
Well, they've just started offering plastic bags that are fully biodegradable, according to ASTM D695404 tests performed, and will ultimately degrade harmlessly into carbon dioxide, water, and biomass, starting to degrade after 12 months.
Well, there is biodegradable plastic out there. I have seen some. Someone just gave me a biodegradable spoon made out of plastic, and that's great. The problem in the food packaging industry is that biodegradable stuff usually is counterproductive because who wants to wrap your food into something that microbes know how to eat? But I think 12 months is really kind of a happy compromise, and if that bag is actually what they say it is, I am delighted. I know that some biodegradable plastic bags out there, because it's in the book, some scientists tested these things. There's just sort of cornstarch that's mixed up with the plastic, and the thing falls apart, but the little pieces of plastic still remain. So I commend Wild Oats if they are doing the right thing now.
Okay, and along the same lines, the Jewel food stores are now selling paper, woven fibrous paper shopping bags at 10 for a dollar that, they're saying, don't take plastic bags, use these over and over.
I'm not sure why we need 10 of them, but look, I commend all these efforts. Somebody just showed me a bag that Trader Joe's is offering out of recycled plastic. It's insulated. It's got a zipper. It's smart looking. I mean, it's kind of a nice thing that you can use over and over again. So at one time or another, I shop at all these places. We all kind of, have to, unless we're farmers and grow our own food, which is, by the way, I recommend if you're in an area where you've got people growing food around you, do that first. But anything that we can do to lower the number of bags either going to our landfills or ending up in our oceans and ending up being ingested by other creatures, this is a great direction for us to be headed in, and I hope it becomes a groundswell.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Thank you. And I misspoke. I said that Jewel is selling them 10 for a dollar. It's 10 for 10. So it's not quite the bargain. I did not tune in at the very beginning, so maybe you've already answered this, but what are the consequences of creatures eating all this plastic?
The answer is...
Go right through them? Don't farmers, ranchers actually feed their beef cattle plastic?
If they do, I'm not aware of it, but here's what the scientists showed me. They showed me their experiments. Yes, some plastic passes right through, and it may be harmless, though, I was just talking to a marine biologist about this the other day, and it's in my book, that plastics floating in the sea tend to become like sponges that PCBs and other chemicals that we now wish we had never made, they sort of adhere to. So even if an animal passes it through, it's probably dissolving or absorbing a lot of this coating of nasty chemicals on the way. But what so often happens is that animals will ingest a particle of plastic, and then they'll ingest another particle of plastic, and suddenly there's so much plastic in their gut that it can't pass through them. Then they die, and they're finding seabird carcasses, and they're finding lots of seabird carcasses with pounds of plastic in them. So as there's plastic for things from seabirds all the way down to zooplankton size, this becomes a cumulative problem.
Let's talk a little about some of the agricultural things that we've done over time. And one of the more fascinating chapters of the book was when you visited a laboratory in the UK, which has kept soil samples and experimented with land use types for centuries, and has some good examples as to what would happen with land that may have been used for agriculture and then not used over time, which would be the situation without humans.
Yeah, it's always a challenge for journalists to write about agriculture in a way that people want to read about it. It's not so exciting. You plant a seed and you wait 6 months and something comes up. But I was fortunate enough to find a fascinating story in England. I mean, first of all, it had occurred to me, so much of our land is devoted to to food production. I mean, outside of the polar areas, a third of the terrestrial Earth is either in grazing or in cultivation. And, you know, what would happen if we were gone? Well, in terms of cultivation, you know, first I was looking, I live in western Massachusetts, and there are a lot of fields that, you know, huge forests were cleared in colonial times. They were planted by farmers who came over from England. And then as the U.S. opened up and went westward, a lot of them abandoned those fields because they moved down into Ohio Territory, which had, and further, which had warmer growing seasons, Illinois, for example.
Better land.
You know, longer growing seasons and less glacial boulders, fewer great glacial boulders to deal with. But that land pretty much was cultivated before the days of fertilizers, and now it's, and other chemical inputs, and now it's coming back to original forests. Still don't have 250-foot trees, those white pines that turned into ships and churches, but in another 250 years, they'll be back.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had to think about, okay, so what happens post-fertilizer? The place in England that I went to, the Rothamsted Research Center, was founded by the guy who first patented fertilizers in the 1840s, and he astutely set out a bunch of test strips to see what happens on this land when you do various combinations of plants, you know, rotation or monoculturing them and use various kinds of fertilizers. And then later, as pesticides and herbicides came in, they started adding those things to the mix and more test strips. And over 160 years, these experiments have kept on going, you know, adding things like municipal sludge that we now use for fertilizing commercial crops. And also, occasionally, they would let some of these fields just go completely fallow to see, okay, so what would happen if we weren't cultivating anymore? And the results are, you know, it's phenomenal that they've got this archive of data and of actual plant matter, et cetera, to show us. It was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen.
And jars of soil dating back to the 1840s.
Oh, it's beautiful, these old calligraphy labels.
Uh-huh.
But you also see very clearly that the fields that have seen various kinds of fertilizers, they take a long time. They eventually will come back to forest. But the soil has become so acidic because so many nutrients have been leached out of them. On the other hand, heavy metals, particularly now in this age of using so much municipal sludge for fertilizer all over the Western world, that stuff impedes metals from leaching, and some of these metals are going to stay in the soil for just an amazing amount of time. Lead will stay in the soil for about, you know, 35,000 years, and there's another one, I believe it's chromium, that will go until, you know, about 70,000 years. So it's really of some concern that we concentrated a lot of metals and put them up in our exhaust, and now they are down there, and you know, plants are going to have to deal with this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But what nature seems to do is it finds something that will grow there. And so, you know, we'll call them weeds, but these things will come up, and then they'll decay, and they will lay down some organic matter, which gradually will improve and create more topsoil, and eventually those heavy metals will get buried, and eventually we will come back to mature and very biodiverse forests as more and more stuff is able to grow in richer and richer soil. It's just going to take time.
How about domesticated crops? I mean, we're surrounded by corn and soybeans and wheat, and we grow beef cattle and pigs and that sort of thing. What would be the fate of those plants? You mentioned that in a lot of the cases, things that we have synthesized for our own use may not stand the test of time.
Well, a lot of our laboratory-engineered crops, you know, the Green Revolution crops, for example, and now some of our genetically modified crops, a lot of them need heavy care from us, heavy chemical inputs, because growing in a laboratory is one thing. Growing out there in an ecosystem with a lot of tough competitors, that's another. And they're just not going to survive. I mean, even an original experiment at this place, wheat. I mean, wheat's an introduced species in India. It all comes out of, you know, the Middle East, Tigris-Euphrates area originally. And within just 4 years, in a wheat field that they abandoned, wheat was no longer growing there. Native species had taken it over. However, there are some of these new species, and really some of the bioengineered ones, we just don't know enough about them yet to see if something has either accidentally or intentionally has some incredible hardiness in it that it will suddenly become dominant, and it's there to stay. I think of even greater concern is some of the nanoparticles that we are now engineering that are delivered by some of these plants. These things are getting loose into the ecosystem, and they're going to be again ingested by all sorts of creatures. Things like PCBs, which is bigger than it's a rather complicated molecule that we stopped making, but there's nothing in nature that breaks it down anymore.
Right.
And that's, soils are filled with this stuff, and it's going to be lodged in there for an awful long time. I would say most of our engineered plants, they are not going to be survivors unless we're not around. I mean, think of our domestic animals. Cows, we have selected them in such a way that most of them are just sort of these big, fat, digestive machines. They don't look a lot like the original wild cattle of Africa and in the Middle East. And predators are going to pick them off pretty easily. I mean, here in North America, buffalo will take over those ranges. On the other hand, horses, which did evolve in North America and crossed land bridges to other continents, and then when Homo sapiens disappeared, they and a lot of other big animals disappeared. But then Coronado and Columbus brought them back, and they have reestablished themselves in that empty equine niche in the Great Basin, Utah, parts of Arizona, etc. You find wild horses and wild burros. They're feral, but now there's a wild population reestablishing, which I think is kind of fitting and proper. And evolutionary biologists now, rather than thinking that these are introduced species, they kind of approve of this.
Let's take one quick last call in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
I'm sorry. If you've already covered this, I apologize. I came in late, but I'm an ecologist, and I think probably the biggest thing that the end of humans would bring if instantly we disappeared as far as the ecology goes is that the mixing of species would stop. But still, there's no way. Oh, my dog is barking about mixing of species. But there's no way to know, even if that would just stop today, what endpoints are going to be, because there's a great faunal mixing going on now, and no one knows what the end is going to be. And as far as livestock, pigs will have an enormous impact if suddenly we're not here to keep them somewhat in control. And there's just no predicting.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you about pigs. The Polynesians brought them along to South Sea Islands to feed themselves on the voyage, and now you go to a luau in Hawaii. That's their way of trying to control the feral pig problem there. That's a very successful, exotic entrant. A botanist at New York Botanical Gardens, who showed me this old growth area that they have there in the Bronx, said to me, "Look, we have been introducing native, exotic species for a long time. People want me to put this forest back the way it was 200 years ago. It's impossible at this point. However, this has been happening throughout history. You go into the jungles of Burma and you see these tea tree groves in the middle of nowhere, or nut groves in the Brazilian Amazon. Those are signs of ancient societies that have now been swallowed up by the wilderness, but they're just sort of little biological echoes of the stuff that they used to cultivate. And even though we value native species on the one hand, on the other hand, what's really important is that we maintain a functioning ecosystem that is filtering the air and filtering the water and keeping the soil in place. Everything always changes. We have jet-propelled some of these changes. They will bear our imprint, but life will go on. And that, to me, that's comforting.
Thank you for your call. And in conclusion, I mean, it sounds that if we ask the question, what would happen if we weren't here, may not necessarily matter if we're not going to be here. But through answering the question, you pose some questions about what we should do while we're still here, I suppose.
Absolutely. You know, I want us to find a way so we can live in harmony, not in combat with the rest of nature. And, you know, we don't have time to go into it, but I pose some interesting, you know, at least one interesting question at the end of the book, like how are we going to do this if we're still increasing by a million more people every 4 days?
Right.
But ultimately, you know, we pride ourselves on being a creature that can envision the future and the consequences of our acts. I hope that we develop the wisdom to act upon that knowledge.
Well, thanks for your vision in this book, The World Without Us. And thank you for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure.
Alan Wiseman is the author of the book, The World Without Us. It's from Thomas Dunn Books, which is a division of St. Martin's Press. It is now 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices are in now from the Chicago Board of Trade, and with those numbers, here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Tom. Taking a look at the numbers in Chicago for the soft red winter wheat, a 14.5 cent loss today. They were down 14.5 with the settlement price at 845.5. The high price for the soft red nearby lead option contract, $8.76 and a quarter. It's the December futures. For their high, the low at 835, and once again the settlement at 845.5, down 14.5 today. March futures 888.88 and a quarter. The high. The low at 848, settlement price at 858, down 13.5 in the May contract. 821 was the high. The low at 790.5, a settlement price at $8, even down 2.5 cents. July futures 673.25, the high. The low at 50.5, settlement price at 660.5, up 3.25. That's right. July futures gained 3.25 cents today, and September futures were up 2.25, 664.25. The settlement price, the high at 677. September for next year at 656.5. On the low, a settlement price 664.25 for the September wheat, up 2.25 on the afternoon. December corn futures $3.48 and 3 quarters, the high. The low at 38.25, a settlement price at 342.5. Up 2.75. March futures up 3.25 at 359.5. The high at 65. The low at 54.75. And the May corn, $3.75. The high. The low at 365.5. A settlement price at 369.25. Up 2.25. September futures 390. The high. The low at 81. Settlement price at 385. Up 2.5. And December futures 398.5. The high. The low at 89. Settlement price at $3.93. Up 2. March futures 405.5, the high, the low at 398. Settlement price at 403, 2.5 cents higher. May contract up 3 cents at 408, the high at 405. And I have a low at 405 as well, but of course the high has to be at least 408. They were up 3 for the May 2009 contract. December oats 278, the high, the low at 68.25. Settlement price at 271.5, up 1 cent. And the March oats at 283 finished a penny higher for the day. Soy complex now, nearbys, November, 950.25, the settlement price, up 24.75. Their high was at 952.75, the low at 922, settlement price at 950.25, up 24.75 for the November soybeans. January futures, 970, the high, a 30-cent trading range, down to 940 for the low. Settlement price at 968.75, up 26.75 in the March at 981.5, top, bottom at 53. Their settlement price a lot closer to the top at $9.80.5, up 24.75. May futures 986.25, the high, the low at 59.75, settlement price at 984.5, up 22.75. And July futures 993.75, the high, the low at 65. Settlement price at $9.92, up 22.25. August contract, 984, the high, the low at 55. Settlement price at $9.85, up 22. And September's 256.25, the high. Low at 236.5, a settlement price at $9.57. They were up 22 on the afternoon. Next year's November's 938.25, the high, the low at 14. Settlement price at 935.75, 19.5 cents higher. Bean meal futures October 264.50, the high, the low at 256.60, settlement price at 263.30 a ton. They were up $8.60. December futures up 8.60 as well at $269.10, the high at 270.60, the low at 260.20. October bean oil futures 35.55, the high, the low at 36.22, and a settlement price at 38.45, up 47. And December futures for the day, 39.15, the high, the low at 38.33, settlement price at 38.99. They finished 51 higher. I'll return at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock during the closing market report this afternoon, which is just about 10 minutes away now, Central Time. We'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana, and K-State grain analyst and biofuels specialist Mike Wolverton will join us on our weekly look at the energy markets at about 25 after the hour. That all comes up during the closing market report. Stay with us. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
On the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the October nearby live cattle contract today had a high of 94.25 and a low of 93.65. The settlement price, 93.90. That was up 17.5 points on the day. December live cattle had a high of 96.87.5, the low 96.30, settlement 96.50, up 25. February, the high today 98.67.5, the low 98.20, the settlement price 98.25. That was down 2.5. And April had a high of 98.77.5, the low 98.30, the settlement 98.55, up 12.5. On to the feeder cattle pit, the October contract had a high of 113.80, the low 112.75, the settlement 113.25, down 60 on the day. November had a high of 114.05, the low 112.85, settled at 113.25, same as the October, down 65. January feeders had a high of 113.65, the low 112.75, and a settlement of 113.47.5, down 5. March was the only up contract in feeders today, the high 112.65, the low 111.90, settlement 112.57.5, up 22.5. October lean hogs at a high of 57.70, the low 57.30, settlement 57.47.5, down 20. December, 60.10 was the high, the low 59.32.5, settlement price 59.72.5, up 25. February lean hogs, the high today 66.40.